Good morning. This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the April 22nd edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners, one of which will be coming up next week. I had not intended to devote another program to the ongoing negotiations over Iran's nuclear program so soon. President Obama's sudden decision, however, to drop his threat to veto any legislative attempt by Congress to interfere with the outcome of those negotiations made returning to that subject almost obligatory. The president's attempt to put a positive spin on his now agreeing to sign a bill that would limit his presidential powers and allow the Israeli-dominated Congress to maintain the sanctions on Iran didn't fly with the national media that has shown little enthusiasm for the deal. Under the headline, quote, President yields to giving Congress say on Iran deal, end quote, the New York Times reported how the president simply got overrun, end quote, by, quote, an unusual alliance of Republican opponents of the nuclear deal and some of President Obama's strongest Democratic supporters, end quote, who demanded a congressional role in the negotiations. There was, in fact, nothing unusual about Republicans and Democrats coming together on issues favored by the Israeli government and its leading U.S. lobby, AIPAC, neither of which was mentioned in the 40-column inches devoted to the subject. For years, support for Israel has been the only issue of national and international importance over which both parties drop their animosities of the moment and compete for the title of which one loves Israel the most and the attention of wealthy Jewish donors. This time, their collaboration has more than the usual significance. Should the agreed framework between Iran and the P5 plus one countries, that's the four permanent members of the Security Council in Germany, fail to produce a signed deal among the parties, a U.S. or Israeli attack on Iran's legitimate nuclear facilities would quite likely follow, if not immediately after, and not immediately after Obama leaves office. As far as the U.S. Congress is concerned, history has shown that when it comes to Israel, whatever America's allies may think, in this case Britain, France, and Germany, is inconsequential. To discuss the ramifications of Obama's about-face, I contacted Jamal Abdi, the policy director of the National Iranian-American Alliance and a prior guest on Takes on the World. I'll be speaking with him about 20 minutes past the hour. In the meantime, I'll tell you my opinion as to why Obama backed down that you won't hear anyone anywhere else. It concerns his betrayal and that of the American people by the man who will be the Democrats' leader in the Senate following the retirement of Nevada's Harry Reid. I'm speaking of the influential New York liberal Charles Schumer. Schumer had quietly signed on as a co-sponsor of the Corker-Menendez bill that gives Congress virtual veto power over any Iran deal 2 weeks earlier, but neither he nor AIPAC, which writes and manages Congress's pro-Israel legislation, elected to publicize it, and the media went along with it. It was, I believe, Schumer's announcement during the congressional recess that he was endorsing the bill and his statement that Congress had every right to pass judgment on whatever was negotiated with Iran that convinced Obama his veto would be overridden and led him to throw in the towel. The father of his predecessor, George Herbert Walker Bush, had made a very different decision on September 12, 1991, when faced with a certain congressional override of his veto of legislation authorizing $10 billion in loan guarantees to Israel. He chose to go on television and explain his reasons for doing so to the American people. In that instance, polls taken afterwards showed that the vast majority of the Americans agree with Bush, and consequently Israel's agents in Congress and AIPAC were forced to back down. While the pro-Israel propaganda machinery was strong at the time, 22 years ago, and there were, believe it or not, two senators, Robert Byrd and Adlai Stevenson III, willing to take on Israel, it was not as powerful as it is today, nor was the issue of the loan guarantees taken as seriously in Israel as is its desire to take down Iran at this very moment. If Obama had been counting on Schumer to corral enough Senate Democrats to block the veto override, he hadn't done his homework. Schumer's first loyalty is not to the United States, but to Israel and his perception of the Jewish people, as he made clear when he spoke before AIPAC's National Convention in Washington in the spring of 2010, 5 years ago. Toppling the government of Iran was already the top of AIPAC's agenda, as it had been since 2003, when the U.S., at Netanyahu's urging, had deposed Iraq's Saddam Hussein without the loss of a single life, and Netanyahu promised a bright future for the Middle East in its aftermath. Well, here's Chuck Schumer at that time in full throat.
Gentlemen, we cannot, we must not, we will not allow Iran to obtain a nuclear weapon. We cannot, we must not, we will not turn a blind eye as Iran builds clandestine nuclear reactors and rejects all deals to limit uranium enrichment and thumbs its nose at the IAEA. Can we really call this saber-rattling when they're on the edge of developing the most awesome and deadly weapons mankind has ever known? Diplomatic efforts have failed. We are too close to simply continue those efforts. I believe that when it comes to Iran, we should never take the military option off the table. But I have long argued that economic sanctions can right now be the best way to choke Iran's nuclear ambitions. It is important to remember this about Iran. It is not a stable country. AIPAC knows what to do and is unrelenting in making sure Israel is protected. For that, I thank all 7,800 of you, and I applaud you. Now let me close by telling you about my name. As some of you know, my name is a Hebrew word. Schumer comes from the Hebrew word shomer, which means guardian, watchman. My ancestors were guardians of the ghetto wall of Chortkov in Galicia. And when they came to Ellis Island, they said their name in Yiddish, Schumer, and it got written down as Schumer. To you, I say this, that name was given to me for a reason. For as long as I live, for as long as I have the privilege of serving in the Senate from New York, I will unflinchingly, unstintingly, and with all of my strength be Shomer Yisrael, a guardian of Israel. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Yisrael Chai in Israel and America. The Jewish nation lives now and forever. Thank you.
Well, Charles Schumer may well see himself as a guardian of Israel, but he is a United States senator, and that statement should have ended his political career. I should note here that Schumer mentioned the 7,800 people in attendance at that year's AIPAC conference 5 years ago. Each year, that number has increased and includes at least half the members of Congress. The number attending this year's AIPAC event was 16,000. The New York Times article also quoted Maryland Senator Ben Cardin, who had replaced New Jersey's Robert Menendez as a ranking Democrat on the Foreign Relations Committee after Menendez was indicted for corruption, Cardin saying, quote, "We're involved here. We have to be involved here. Only Congress can change or modify the sanctions regime," end quote. Both Cardin and Menendez, as I mentioned on my last program, are among 8 U.S. senators on the advisory board of the Israel Project, a right-wing Jewish organization that lobbies the media for Israel. Well, today, Cardin, again on Israel's behalf, will be introducing legislation that would punish any country or company that supports the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement targeting Israel's settlements by refusing to do business with Israel or any Israeli business operating in the occupied West Bank. That's not for America, my listeners. That is for Israel. And there's more. Before Obama's capitulation, according to the Wall Street Journal, a group of Jewish Democratic House members met with the White House Chief of Staff, Dennis McDonough, and warned that for them to help, quote, sell a very unpopular Iran nuclear deal to our constituents, Obama must, quote, increase his popularity with our constituents, end quote, as the Journal quoted one Democratic congressman as saying. Then Leonard Barak, a longtime Democratic fundraiser, told the Journal, quote, that many fellow Democrats of the Jewish faith were appalled at some Democratic congressmen did not show Prime Minister Netanyahu, quote, the respect and courtesy of being in the audience, end quote, when he spoke to Congress. Well, Israeli officials welcomed the news from Washington with Yuval Steinitz, the Minister of Intelligence and Strategic Affairs, describing Congress's getting Obama to back down as, quote, an achievement for Israeli policy, unquote. Then he goes on, this is more pressure and another barrier in the face of a bad agreement, he explained on Israeli radio, noting that it will mean negotiators are more likely to push for a deal acceptable to Congress. Well, Israeli columnist Gideon Levy, speaking in Washington on April 10th at a conference on the Israel lobby in which I participated, had a different take on the situation. Said Levy, let's call it now the United States of Israel. Because many times, he said, when someone looks at the relations between Israel and the United States, one might ask, who is really the superpower between the two? And those questions became much more valid in recent days when you see what is going on in Iran. I am not in a position to tell Americans what to feel, Levy said. But I would be an American. If I was an American, I would really be embarrassed. When you see a title in Haaretz, in my newspaper, which says 2 days ago, Israel to pressure Congress to thwart Iranian nuclear deal, and an Israeli official says to Haaretz that Israel will lobby the U.S. Congress to pass legislation that would make it difficult for even impossible to approve a comprehensive deal with Iran. Well, can you imagine yourself if it was the opposite? If someone had written that the Americans are trying to act in the Israeli parliament to change its decisions. We are dealing now really with almost questions of sovereignty, declared Levy. We are dealing, needless to say, with something that no state in the world would have dared to do, and no statesman in the world. And I will tell you frankly, it's not Israel's fault. Israel's doing whatever it can. It's the fault of the ones who enabled it. End quote. Well, Levy was one of the featured participants in the National Press Club event organized by the Institute for Research Middle East Policy, whose director, Grant Smith, you have heard many times in this program. And the Washington Report for Middle East Affairs, a monthly magazine that since 1982 has monitored Israel's control over Congress and provided an antidote to the fictions of the Middle East that dominate the U.S. media. On the opening panel of the conference, in which I spoke about the history of the Anti-Defamation League spying on Americans and its questionable ties with law enforcement agencies and the FBI going back to the 30s, I welcomed the PAC Press Club Auditorium to Washington with a declaration that our nation's capital is Israel's most important occupied territory. And I said this would be proved by the total absence of coverage of the conference by the mainstream media. I was right, of course. C-SPAN had, to my pleasant surprise, covered last year's conference devoted to reevaluating the Israel-U.S. relationship from beginning to end, but there was nary a mention of it in the national media nor on Democracy Now! It can still be viewed online. This year, apparently succumbing to pressure, it chose not to be there despite the fact that Congress. My inquiry as to why C-SPAN was absent, given the presence of some well-known public figures on the various panels, received no reply. In addition to Levy, the most well-known Israeli columnist outside of Israel, among the participants were two former members of Congress, Paul Finley, Republican from Illinois, targeted for defeat years ago after speaking kind words about the Palestinians, and Nick Rahal, a West Virginia Democrat who was defeated last November thanks to AIPAC and the Tea Party, and former UN Rapporteur for Gaza, Professor Richard Falk. Finley and Rahal shared a panel with former AIPAC staff member and now one of his fiercest critics, M.J. Rosenberg, who I believe was speaking publicly about his experiences for the first time. The entire event, however, was videoed and streamed live and can be seen and heard online at israellobbyus.org. That's israellobbyus, one word, .org. Stepping into the breach to give the conference further publicity was Ralph Nader, whose blog post was picked up by Counterpunch, Dissident Voice, and Common Dreams. Said Nader, quote, following the heavy coverage of AIPAC's, the virulently pro-Israel government lobby, multi-day annual Washington convention in March, the mainstream media might have been interested for once in covering alternative viewpoints like those discussed at the April 10th conference. Said Nader, the Israel lobby, is it good for the U.S., is it good for Israel? Fairness and balance in reporting should produce at least some coverage of such an event. The day-long program at the prestigious National Press Club, he said, should have been intriguing to reporters. After all, wrote Nader, clearly tongue-in-cheek, are they not interested in important, taboo-challenging presentations on a critical dimension of U.S. foreign military policy? The presenters were much more newsworthy than most of the speakers at the AIPAC convention, who redundantly restated the predictable AIPAC line, declared Nader. Well, again, you can see and hear it all at Israel Lobby Us, one word, .org. Opening the day's program was Grant Smith, one of the conference's organizers and a frequent guest on Takes on the World, as I mentioned before. Smith gave a rundown on what he identified as Israel affinity groups, the ones that make up the lobby, describing their growth and likely future expansion. He also spoke about his recent successful suit to force the CIA to release a previously classified Department of Defense document from 1987 that revealed for the first time that Washington was fully aware of Israel's nuclear weapons program and its effort to build a hydrogen bomb. It was entitled Critical Technology Assessment in Israel and NATO Nations, and thanks to Grant Smith, you can now find it online. A major premise of his lawsuit was that U.S. taxpayers had been paying billions of dollars in aid to Israel over the years for which, according to U.S. law, Israel has not been eligible. Amendments made in 1976 to the Foreign Aid Act of 1961 prohibit the U.S. from providing aid to any foreign government not a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty that is found to have a nuclear weapons program, and Israel never signed that treaty. Adjusting for inflation, according to Smith, Israel has received $234 billion in today's dollars since the amendment has passed. Well, like Edward Snowden's revelations about the NSA, this became a major story in the media, right? Democracy Now! Was all over it, right? No, wrong. They all ignored it. Some American Jewish weeklies carried the story and elected to overlook the facts of the document and suggested that Obama had approved the release of the information in order to embarrass Israel. That Israel had been stealing money from American taxpayers was not their concern. However, Israeli journalist Michael Karpin, writing in the New York Jewish Weekly Forward on April 3rd, had a different take. Karpin, who previously had written a book on Israel's bomb back in 2006, was blown away by the report. He wrote, I have some knowledge about the buildup of Israel's nuclear capacity, and after reading the report in question, I must express my astonishment. I have never seen, Karpin wrote, an official American document disclosing such extensive revelation on subjects that until now were regarded by both administrations as unspeakable. End quote. After crediting Smith with pursuing and obtaining the report, Karpin notes that, quote, although the report reveals a wide compilation of new facts about Israel's most covert defense industry, to my astonishment, its declassification produced no media reverberation whatsoever, neither in Israel, except on the Ynet News website, or in the United States. Somewhat naively, Karpin suggests that, quote, in light of Iran's nuclear talks, the declassification's timing could prove troublesome for Israel. It makes it much harder, he wrote, to maintain a policy of ambiguity about Israel's nuclear program and subsequently helps Iran's argument that it shouldn't be denied its own ambitions, end quote, Michael Karpin. Well, aside from Iran having shown no evidence that it desires to build a nuclear weapon, Karpin overestimates the integrity of the U.S. media. When it comes to Israel, it doesn't have any.